Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for clicking on the latest Peter B. Collins Show. It's supported by great listeners, including Susan Fellows, Teresa Paris, Joe Kells, the tennis pro, and Patricia Player. If you'd like to help, go to my website. The details are on the right-hand side of the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Well, it's time for a frank discussion with Thomas Frank. He is the lead essayist for Harper's Magazine, has many other credentials, and as you're about to hear him ruthlessly plug his new book, it's called Pity the Billionaire. Returning to our program today is Thomas C. Frank. He is the lead essayist, it's called Easy Chair, in Harper's Magazine. He published What's the Matter with Kansas, The Wrecking Crew, and his new book, can we have some trumpets or something? Pity the Billionaire is going to be in bookstores in early January. Tom Frank, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
It's good to be here, Peter B.
Well, it's good to see you, and our listeners can't see us, but I'm looking at you on this Skype thing, and it just makes it so personal, intimate, and all that.
It's an amazing thing. The earlier today, I actually did it. I talked to a guy in Barcelona, Spain.
Yeah. Skype is very cool. I got to pay a last visit to a friend who died just after Christmas last year on Skype, and it was really powerful. And I also stay in touch with a couple of guys who spent more than 8 years at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, who have been displaced to countries they've got no connection to. And we talk on Skype on a regular basis. It's really cool.
While they were there, did they have to read the Seven Habits of Highly the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People?
Stephen Covey.
Yes, but by any chance, I wrote one of my essays in Harper's was about someone who's being held there, a detainee at Guantanamo, and he's very young. He was a child soldier. Or that's what he's accused of being. I guess he actually was a child soldier, and but they had him read the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
That would be Omar Khadr, the Canadian. Khadr,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a very powerful documentary that I have seen, but it hasn't been in wide distribution yet. That shows the interrogation of Omar Khadr by Canadian intelligence agents. And it's chilling in so many ways, but what really comes through is how bright this kid is and how he's got the number of the people who are running the whole game at Guantanamo. And I hope that it gets a wider release. A Canadian group produced it, and they were film festivaling it over the last few months.
Well, oh, so it's brand new.
It is.
'Cause I've never heard of this before. I would have known about that. I mean, there was a time when I was very up to speed on all things Omar Khadr, but that was some months ago.
Yeah. Well, I believe he has been sent to Canada where he's serving out the rest of his sentence, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And now, I also know everything there is to know about Jack Abramoff, who's back in the news now. Have you seen this?
Well, I have an interview scheduled with Mr. Abramoff next week. And he has moved it three times, so I hope that that doesn't mean that he's figured out who I am and what I'm going to ask him.
Well.
And I don't want to spoil it, but I have a surprise for Jack Abramoff when I do the interview, and I'll just have to tell you about it afterward. Okay, Tom?
You're gonna play Carry On, My Wayward Son.
No, I only do that to torture you.
Yeah.
And I should pull out some Kansas. I'm remiss in that. Well, listen, since we touched on Guantanamo, can I start off with the bone that the biggest bone I have to pick with Washington these days is what is attached to the defense spending bill, the so-called NDAA for 2012. And there's been a back and forth, and as you and I are speaking here on the 14th of December, it appears that language in one section would exclude Americans from unlimited detention without charge or trial, the Gitmo treatment. And other sections appear to remain to include Americans. Carl Levin, the senior senator from Michigan who chairs the committee that reported out this bill, says that it was the White House who instructed him to remove the language that clearly excluded Americans from this unconstitutional prospect of detention without charge or trial. Your thoughts, Mr. Frank?
You've been, okay, I know a little bit about this, but only what I read in the newspapers, and you're talking about it with a double negative. I believe that the bill allows them to detain Americans without trial, right?
One section does. Section, yeah. I believe.
Well, that's of course an outrage. I mean, I can't. Well, first of all, the Supreme Court will immediately strike that down. But let's keep our fingers crossed. You know, this is a strange time. You never know what the Supreme Court will do nowadays. But that seems like just a blatant violation of constitutional protections. So, I mean, it's an outrage. The whole thing is an outrage.
There's also a lot of confusion, and there should be no confusion about a clear constitutional right to due process, to face your accusers, to be charged and tried in a timely manner. All that is included in the Bill of Rights that currently apply to Americans. Now, here's the latest from my San Francisco Chronicle's Washington Bureau, published here on the 14th of December. It says that one section bars military arrest of U.S. citizens and permanent resident aliens, but citizens and legal residents are included in Section 1021 of the bill, which allows the military to arrest and detain terrorist suspects. So the fact that there's even any confusion about this, or that there would be conflicting language in different clauses of this bill, this is inexcusable. This is a giveaway of our rights. And if they do that, it should be debated. It should be done in a very clear manner.
Oh, yeah. You're not kidding. There's, you know, I don't know. The thing is, I want to try to avoid this sort of, you know, the kind of really black pessimism that this sort of thing points you towards. You know, I don't like to think that the people who are running this country are that stupid or that evil or a combination of those two things that they would do something like that. You know, and I like to think that the Supreme Court will immediately take action and reverse it. You know, that sounds to me like this, right on the face of it, violation of the 14th Amendment as well as the Bill of Rights.
Now, are we talking about the same Supreme Court, Tom?
Okay, good question.
Because
I know the Supreme Court is packed with conservatives these days, but, you know, some of those guys are pretty libertarian. You know, they allow for all sorts of crazy things regarding corporations, but you'd think they would still, they'd still have their head on straight as it regards civil liberties. That's what I hope. What can I say, Peter B. Collins? I mean, I'm trying to stay upbeat about the world right
and
now.
Isn't
okay?
it,
don't,
isn't
don't
it,
bring me down.
I'm sorry. Isn't it difficult? Can we acknowledge the challenge?
It is difficult, but hey, if it makes you feel any better, if the Republicans really nominate Newt Gingrich, it's going to be, you know, Obama is definitely getting a second term.
Well, I know a lot of people move pretty quickly from the weakness of the Republican nominees to an easy victory for Barack Obama. I still haven't seen an Electoral College map that shows him with 270 votes. We have this murky group of centrists that want to use the internet to nominate one Democrat and one Republican on a ticket.
I've met some of those guys, yeah.
They claim to have bought ballot space in all 50 states, and Ross Perot wasn't able to do that.
Come on, you can buy ballot space? Are you kidding me, Peter B. Collins? Now that would annoy me.
They don't have a political party, they don't have candidates, and they claim that they have ballot access in all 50 states. I say prove it. And number two, this is a group that has not disclosed who the donors are of the $23 million that they claim to have collected so far. And they
What's also funny about that is that isn't Obama centrist enough for them?
Well, he's been trying to stake out leadership of the mythical centrist party.
Yeah, but it's never good enough, right? So, politics is such a funny thing, because you know you see the same attitudes sort of reflected on the right. You know, they're very unhappy with their candidates. No one is authentic enough. And, of course, on the left, you see people like me. What's funny is that centrists have the same disability. Nobody's an authentic enough centrist. Of course, I think all these other people are saying that in bad faith and that I've got the only true authenticity critique, you know? Mine is the right one. Mine's the authentic authenticity critique.
You're going to have to arm wrestle me for that. Because I'm the authentic and early disaffected Obama supporter.
Yes. And I was earlier than you.
Well,
he was my state senator, remember? way back when, in the 1990s in Chicago.
All right. You win that one. But it does revolve around these constitutional issues. It's for me, it's less about the jobs bill or any particular initiative of Barack Obama. The big picture is that George W. Bush established a very aggressive new beachhead of executive power, and Obama has solidified that and in some cases expanded it. And this incursion,
despite remember promising to do exactly the reverse,
right?
I mean, and this wasn't like the kind of things that I hoped he would do. I hoped he would do all sorts of Rooseveltian things. These are things he said he would do.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
He was very upfront about that, about what he was going to do with Gitmo and the Patriot Act and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and this Skype call may be encrypted and may not actually be accessible to the National Security Administration, but everything else we do is. All our phone calls, all our emails are subject to interception. And
not my Harper's Magazine articles, though.
Yeah?
To read those, they'd have to get a subscription. They can't just get it for free.
Yeah, I know Rick MacArthur's really tough on free stuff on the web.
That's right.
He doesn't want to give it away. Well, let's talk about and put this in a little context, because it wasn't so long ago that Barack Obama caved in to the Republicans and agreed to extend the Bush tax cuts for the ultra wealthy without paying for those tax cuts.
But okay, you say that he caved in. There was no pressure on him from them yet. Didn't he do this while the Democrats still had the House of Representatives? I mean,
it was in the lame duck session.
Exactly.
Last
so
year.
Why did he do it? You know, you'd think that has been one of the great mysteries of the Obama years as they unfold. Is that he had that ace in the hole. You know, he had a really strong hand, and he gave it away.
Yes.
He didn't trade it for anything.
Wait a minute. He got some unemployment benefit extensions, and he got what he asked for, which was this temporary payroll tax cut. And this puts $5 to $10 a week into the pockets of people who are working. So it has a mild stimulative effect. It doesn't have any impact in terms of creating new jobs. And
it's a big nothing.
If it's not paid for, it then is a raid on the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, I've heard different arguments about how this year's payroll tax cut was paid for, and I'm still not convinced that the same amount of money that should have gone into the trust fund did. We're now being told that Republicans want to pay for the extension of Obama's payroll tax cut with some funny money. And they also want to link it to the Keystone XL pipeline, which, of course, is a very ugly, toxic, nuclear kind of attachment for the left in Congress. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts about this payroll tax cut, because I think Obama really boxed himself into several corners on this
and comes out with
nothing.
You saw his speech in Osawatomie, Kansas.
Yes, I did.
Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and I, by the way, and that was real good for my career. I got to be on TV again because I'm the only guy, in their Rolodex who knows how to pronounce Osawatomie.
And where did you appear? I missed it. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm just kidding. It doesn't matter.
No, I want to know. Who interviewed you?
It was on MSNBC.
Okay. Dylan Ratmore or?
No, it was Ed Schultz.
Oh, good. Good. Okay.
But I don't know if you're aware of this. Osawatomie is the home of John Brown.
Yes,
that's why
I am.
That's why politicians go there. Mm-hmm. That's why Teddy Roosevelt went there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, John Brown, when people still remembered the Civil War, John Brown was a hero figure.
Right.
And those days are long forgotten now. But because Teddy Roosevelt gave his great populist speech there, Obama went back and did the same thing. And I thought Obama's speech was really good and really wonderful. And it's the kind of language I love to hear from Barack Obama. But then at the end of it all, you know, he's talking about the concentration of wealth in this country and how unsustainable it is. And, you know, that's the wrong word for it. What an outrage it is. And what's his answer? A payroll tax cut. Are you kidding me? That's it? That's what you're going to do to turn this around? That's it? You know, a payroll tax cut, you know, fine. We're in a serious slump. Nothing is turning it around. Okay, fine. You can do something like that. But the effects that that's going to have on unemployment are marginal. I mean, they are tiny.
Zero.
It'll have some effect, but it won't be great. It'll definitely have a better effect than if you say cut taxes for millionaires like the Republicans want to do. If you mm-hmm. know, pity the billionaire and cut their taxes, it'll do better than that. But it's still it's not going to help the problem very much. You know what would help the problem? You want to know how you solve the unemployment problem, Peter B. Collins?
You put a W and a P and an A together.
That's right. You hire people. You want to stop on it. You want to bring unemployment down. You want to end unemployment. Go out and hire people. It's just the simplest thing in the world. And you know, I've been watching this debate we've been having in this country with just increasing incredulity that we've now convinced ourselves as a nation that the only way to create jobs is to make small business happy, and the only way to make them happy is to. The right says you have to give them everything, every last item on their legislative wish list, and the Democrats say, we'll do something else, and it'll, you know, give them some kind of tax cut or something like that, and this will please them, and it'll, if you want to employ people, employ people.
Oh, Tom, come on, that is so old school. We've got to cut the onerous regulation that ties the hand of the entrepreneur who wants to hire people so badly, but the government is in his way. They throw up all kinds of obstacles. They make him follow rules that won't kill the workers that he employs. He's not allowed to hire 13-year-olds, even though Nudie wants him to. I mean, you don't understand what the entrepreneur is facing.
What he goes through, I know. But, Peter, has it ever occurred to you that while they're – at the very moment that they're making these claims, you pick up the newspaper and read about how they – you know, the Bush administration undermined the regulation of Wall Street in all these different ways. It allowed all the predatory lending, allowed all of the packaging up of the mortgages, allowed all the credit default swaps. It was because of their, you know, the deregulatory proposals. And at the same, and then while all this is going on, just last week across the headlines comes this news of what went on at the upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia, where all those people were killed last year.
Right.
It's because they weren't regulated anymore. Yes, they were regulated on paper, but they were easily able to deceive the regulators who had no enforcement power. And, you know, and now they've got away with it. They've got away with it. None of them are going to go to jail. Or, I mean, like, wait, I don't know if that's right. But the report is basically they settled for a couple million dollars.
If it ain't fixed, don't broke it.
Oh, Peter B. Collins, yeah. Anyhow, so
let's go back to Osawatomie.
There's an obvious answer to this problem, the problem of unemployment.
But I want to introduce another issue here, and that is Occupy. And I think that the president's speech in Osawatomie did, in many respects, reflect the concerns and some of the aspirations, as loosely defined as they are, of the Occupy movement. And I do give him credit for attempting to acknowledge the pain of displaced people and attempting to at least rhetorically strike a pose with the 99% instead of the 1%. But I would argue that beyond the speech and the nice framing, that the president needs to grab a couple of those Wall Street bankers by the Gucci loafers and hang them upside down and make an example out of them. Because, you know, I recently talked to Bill Black. He was the regulator who led the enforcement.
He's a friend of mine. He's a great man.
He is. Yeah. And he pointed out that the savings and loan boondoggle of the 1980s cost about $150 billion. There were nearly 10,000 criminal referrals. There were more than 1,000 felony convictions. And to date, we're looking at losses of somewhere between $7 and $25 trillion, depending on which numbers are accurate. And Bill Black says that exactly 10 people have been sent to jail, and the number of referrals, the criminal referrals that could be in the pipeline for prosecution right now, is minimal to non-existent. And
that's right.
And so Obama could send a clear signal that he sides with the 99% by allowing the Justice Department to investigate, indict, and prosecute some of the people who took us to the brink of economic disaster.
Oh, I know, Peter B., but this was the issue in 2009. This was 2 years ago that we were talking about this. He's lost that, you know, he's lost that game already. That's, you know, if he had done things like that, he might have prevented the Tea Party movement from happening. I mean, if he had taken any of those measures that people like Bill Black were talking about in 08, 09, you know, none of these political disasters that have befallen him would have happened. Okay, to get back to the Harper's story for this month, mm-hmm. If he had, you know, when President Obama had both houses of Congress and he had the adulation of the public. Remember when he was first starting in office in 09 and that all those people out on the Washington Mall to see his inauguration, and he was beloved. I mean, I didn't go to the inauguration, but friends of mine came in from out of town just to see it. You know, I'm a Washingtonian. I'm all jaded, you know, but. It was this great moment. He could have done whatever he wanted. He was a Franklin Roosevelt figure. And he, you know, pushed through this stimulus package that was all these tax cuts and money to states for what they called shovel-ready projects, and it turned out they weren't shovel-ready at all. It would have been easy to tackle unemployment, and we know how to do it thanks to our experience of the 1930s. Government can put people to work. It can. I mean, it's expensive. You can because obviously you're hiring people. You're paying them a salary. You're paying them wages. But you can do it with very low overhead. You know, with a minimal amount of bureaucracy, you can do it quickly. Some of these shovel-ready projects, they're only starting on them right now. You know, he could put millions of people to work, you know, over the next 2 months. They did it in the 30s. It's easy. I could tell them how. Remember Glenn Beck and his red telephone? Call me, Mr. President. Remember that?
No, I didn't watch Glenn Beck.
Oh, you got to read Pity the Billionaire. It's all in there, man. I spent 2 years watching Glenn Beck.
Oh, there's another guy named Tom that I'd like to refer you to. Or actually, another guy named Frank. I blew that. In Washington, Justin Frank is a psychiatrist, and I think you need to get on his couch. He just published Obama on the couch. And
Yes, I have his book about Bush.
Yeah.
Is this Bush on the couch?
Yeah, and now he's done
Obama.
I've
got it around here somewhere.
Right. You guys related?
No.
Oh, well, you Franks ought to get together then.
There's a whole lot of us. I once went to the town in Germany that my ancestors came from, and I was with my brother, and we stopped at a phone booth on the edge of town and got out the, this is in the 80s, and we got out the phone directory, and half the people in the town were named Frank. They're
right.
Everywhere.
Now, coming back to your plan, the biggest problem we have is that Republicans are convinced and have been able to persuade some people in this country that government cannot and does not create jobs. And the whole notion of job creation has become almost a mystical area of discussion. because the Republicans revere the job creators who make millions, if not billions, of dollars and pay less tax than Warren Buffett's secretary.
Pity the billionaire, Peter B. Collins.
Okay, one more plug and I'm going to start charging. So talk a little bit about the myths of job creation.
Okay.
What really drives an economic expansion that produces new job opportunities?
This is the story starts with me watching a speech by John Boehner, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, where he's talking about job creators and how we have to. And he said a very interesting thing, job creators, by which of course he means small businessmen. And he said that job creators are essentially on strike today. Okay, which struck me as being really peculiar, a peculiar thing to say for all sorts of different reasons. First of all, because Republicans almost never sympathize with strikers.
Right, yeah, they have a no-strike clause.
You tell them that there's a general strike crippling the economy and throwing people out of work, and they're like, oh, yeah? Let's have some injunctions. Let's get the National Guard out there.
Let's beat some heads. Let's throw some tear gas canisters and hit some people.
That's right. Let's, throw down some Taft-Hartley, at these people. I mean, they do that instantly. But no, he's identifying with these people and saying, you have to capitulate to the strikers. You have to give in. You have to give them what they want, and what they want is less regulation. They want their taxes cut, this kind of thing. And it all builds on this myth where the only way, and I mean the only way, that you can create jobs is by doing nice things for small business and making them all happy. And I'm just watching this and saying to myself, but I know there's other ways to create jobs. If the government really wanted to create jobs, it should just create jobs. One of the many ironies in Boehner's speech is that he was giving it in the Ronald Reagan building in downtown D.C. It was this enormous federal office building. It's built in the 90s, and it's very, very posh. And he's telling us that only small business can create jobs. And this is something that just everybody in the audience knows. They all agree with that. I mean, of course, that's a no-brainer. That's true. And I'm thinking, first of all, the Ronald Reagan building, no matter what Reagan said, what his particular politics were while he was president, this was something built by the federal government. The people who had jobs working on that building had those jobs because government, paid for it. And second of all, Reagan himself, if you go back and read his memoirs, his dad and his brother were employed by the WPA during the harshest days of the Great Depression. It saved his family, and Reagan is grateful for it. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, is one of the elements of the New Deal that Reagan really approved of. In fact, when he was governor of California, he actually proposed setting up a sort of state-level WPA in California that would give everybody that's out of work that wants a job could have one. If you dig around a little bit, am I just talking too much, Peter B.? You want me to shut up?
I'm fascinated.
If you dig around a little bit, you find that the WPA is, this is big government at its biggest, at its most heavy-handed. This is government coming in and, hiring, government growing, government hiring people, doing all these things, government building government buildings. I mean, isn't that a great one? The government goes in there and builds, office buildings and
right.
stuff like that, builds dams, but people look back at the WPA very, very fondly. Now, I grew up in suburban Kansas City, and the elementary school that I went to was built by the WPA. I don't know if you've ever been to Kansas City, but a lot of the really grand buildings in downtown Kansas City were built by either the WPA or one of the other big public works agencies in the Roosevelt years. We had this, glorious auditorium. It's just beautiful. And they, of course, did everything by hand, right, to make the work go as far as – to make the dollars go as far as they could in employing people. Everything had to be done by artisans. Everything had to be sort of overdone, over-engineered, much grander than it needed to be, in order that way they could employ as many people as they possibly could. But it was so when I was growing up there and thinking about these buildings from the 30s, all of them built by the Roosevelt administration, I thought of it as sort of an American golden age. It never occurred to me that this was the product of economic disaster or sort of secondary product of economic disaster. And I think a lot of Americans probably share that point of view, that things like the WPA are beloved. They aren't something that we hate and mistrust.
Well, in my own, I grew up in Cincinnati, and our public library, the interior was decorated by artists who had been employed by the WPA. And today in California, we just triggered a new round of budget cuts that will further decimate public libraries here in California. They're going to get almost zero funding from the state. And this is just a very clear, important investment to make. And people think with the with the internet and all the technological advances that you can get information on your phone, who needs a library? But I think libraries are very important
as
learning centers, as resource centers. And, we're just deciding that they're unnecessary and, we can afford cops and firefighters, but we can't afford libraries.
Well, the day will come for those other services as well. This is if you don't get your house in order, this is what happens. And I don't mean California. I mean, California has its problems, but I mean nationally when things like that start happening. And we are reliving what happened in the 1930s when states and cities were doing the same thing. There's a famous story, Chicago couldn't pay its school teachers, I think, for a whole year. And the only way out, this is when Hoover was president, the only way out of something like that is for the federal government to step in, because state and local governments aren't allowed to run deficits.
And this is my point, that in the last 2 years, at some point, the president should have launched an initiative to shift money from the federal government to the state level so that the efforts to stimulate the economy that he undertook in 2009 won't just be offset. Because that's what's happening right now. California is laying off more people than the stimulus package hired.
And these are people
who have full-time jobs with benefits and pensions and health care. And those jobs are going away, and we're not preserving the infrastructure and the commons. We're hollowing it out.
But if you're worried about unemployment, and every American should be worried about it, I mean, it's a terrible thing when that happens to people. And you could be next. I mean, everyone knows that. But if you're worried about unemployment, what you just described is one of the easiest ways to fight it, is for the federal government to step in and make sure that the states don't lay people off. They call it counter-cyclical spending. You try to do the opposite of what the business cycle is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how we view things here in Washington anymore. And so President Obama has the world at his feet, and what does he choose to do? Tax cuts. Tax cuts, more tax cuts,
Well, and we have to recall that he bent to the whims of the Republicans the 780 or so in stimulus, $780 billion, was at least 40% tax cuts that had no impact or benefit. And
they had some. They didn't have much.
Yeah.
This is the thing, is that they can quantify what has the most effectiveness in fighting unemployment. And tax cuts are way, way, way down the list. Way high up the list are things like what you just described, transfer money to the states so that they don't lay people off. Another one is, weirdly enough, food stamps. For whatever reason, that's very effective. But what I'm talking about, direct hiring by the federal government, is the most effective thing they can do. Just if you want to create jobs, go out there and create them. And this is one of the things that was really fun about writing the story, was thinking about the ways they could do this. The Roosevelt administration, they were very creative. This is one of the things I love about reading about the 1930s, is they just threw the rules out the window and came up with ways of doing things all on their own. So they had this guy called Harry Hopkins. He was a social worker from Iowa, if you can imagine. And Roosevelt really liked him. He was essentially Roosevelt's right-hand man. And Roosevelt said, go out there and, hire people. And this guy, Hopkins, just started blowing money right and left. Now, he did it in a very effective way. He didn't just blow it on, new paper towels for the bathrooms in one of the office buildings here. He put people to work shoveling snow, raking leaves, cleaning up the park. In that first winter of 33-34, that first winter that Roosevelt was in office, he hired something like 4 million people in a matter of months. We have a bigger problem today. I'd hope they could hire more people than that. But you could do it if you had really I don't want to use creative bureaucrats like this guy Harry Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And so I asked my friends if we were setting up a new WPA, what would we do? We have to put all sorts of people to work. What is that? Is that a dog?
Yeah, but the listeners couldn't hear it, so just ignore it. Okay. That's Chloe.
Okay,
quiet.
What would we do if we were setting up a new WPA? How would we employ people all over America? And it's really easy to come up with things that are both, you know, would put people to work, very labor intensive things that are also incredibly useful. For example, you mentioned libraries. Okay, let's build an army of, you know, former graduate students who are unemployed, you know, all of them down at Zuccotti Park or whatever, and send them into the libraries of America to scan the back issue of every newspaper ever published in this country. Wouldn't that be awesome if you could read?
Google might hire them. They've got a project to scan all that stuff. You
know, someone like me, I'd be glued to my computer for the rest of my life. You're, you know, reading every back issue of, you know, the Kansas City Star or something like that.
I'll scan this in a minute. Let me read it.
Yeah. But it would be wonderful. Every back issue of every magazine ever published in this country, you know, something like that. It would be fantastic. Send people out to, you know, build out high-speed internet to little towns on the Great Plains, you know.
How about a citizen audit of Goldman Sachs?
that would be fun. I hadn't thought of that one, but you know, like, you could, all these derelict McMansions all over the country, disassemble them by hand, you know, being very careful to mm-hmm. not damage the granite countertops and the gold-plated toilets or whatever it is. You know, you could come up with all sorts of things that would put people immediately to work.
I've recently become qualified as a toilet installer. I've done two successfully.
Really?
Yeah. I'm trying to expand my work opportunities.
You're a plumber now? Is that right? I'm doing a lot of that sort of thing around the house these days, I tell you what.
Yeah, because...
I'm getting off the subject here, but I...
Your digressions
you
are always fascinating. Go ahead.
Pity the Billionaire anymore, right? Don't talk about it.
I'll plug it for you. His new book, Pity the Billionaire, is due out in January. What's in it?
Yeah, it's largely about... It's a long comparison between the 30s and today. And... when I started writing it, we bought this house that we just moved into that was built actually in 1933.
Oh.
And it's like, how many houses in America were built in 1933? Well, not many. The answer is not very many.
Yeah.
But I'm
so who was the wealthy mofo who owned your house when it was built?
Well, it's Washington, D.C., so this would have been the only city in America that was growing then. Uh-huh. Because everyone was streaming into Washington for the New Deal, you know, coming in to work for the Roosevelt administration. So they started mm-hmm. building suburban homes in the 30s. It's the craziest thing in the world.
And you've had to replace some toilets, I take it.
I actually, as a matter of fact, I have. But I go out of my way to find period toilets.
Oh, yeah.
And all these other period fixtures, light fixtures, and this sort of thing. So I've
so you're a restoration guy, restoration
hardware.
Yeah, well,
I'm an Art Deco. I love Art Deco. So,
mm-hmm. Well, Tom, how do you see these economic issues playing out and into the election next year? And I want to inject Occupy into the equation again, because I do credit the Occupy protesters with changing the national conversation. It was all about debt reduction and
right.
the super
Here,
committee.
In this town, it still is.
And all that bullshit. And the term, you know.
See that on radio, Peter.
We're on a podcast. We can say whatever the F we want. and you can too. So, you know, income inequality is now something that is much more broadly discussed. And I think that even Bush's have mores. Have some sense of the dislocation and the pain that working families are incurring in this country. It doesn't mean they won't stop busting unions and trying to drive out the middle class, but I do think there is some awareness of the problem. How does this translate? Because I'm concerned that there is enough power in the Occupy movement, and at this point they're positioned as apolitical, that we could have a lot of people who simply... don't buy into the election process next year. And as you know, that plays into the hands of conservative Republicans.
That's right. Well, how is it going to play out? First of all, yes, I agree with you. It's a very hopeful thing. They've completely changed the conversation. Now, I don't know whether you know, camping out in a park is the best way to get your point across. I don't think it is, but at least that got the media's attention, that sort of display of commitment. And hey, you know, it worked. So give them props for that. But I think that that part of the strategy, I think that has played itself out. And I think they it has to go forward. I mean, it has to, Peter. I mean, we've just come through this incredible replay of the Great Depression, only without the left turn that you saw in 1932. You know, that just never happened. Instead, we had the Tea Party movement. It's got to happen, or we're just going to go back to things as usual. It's all going to continue to go in the same direction. Things have to change. Now, I want to take issue with what you said about, you know, the very rich finally understanding that things can't go on the way they've been going on. Oh, yes. They don't have any problem with it. I mean, there's people here and there who have a conscience maybe, or know, like Warren Buffett, that have some practical sense that you can't push people that far. But the rest of them, it's just mechanical, Peter. They just want more. They want more. And, you know, and so does everybody else. And so, of course, they're going to resist it. If we are counting on the sympathy of the very rich to solve our problems for us, our problems are never going to be solved. I mean, this has to come from the ground up. And look, what ultimately changed America in the 30s, well, you had a combination of the Roosevelt administration, you know, laying down some stiff regulations on the banks, Wall Street, this sort of thing, but also constant pressure from below. I mean, that's why we had Social Security. You had things like this, the Townsend movement, you know, that was especially out where you are. It was huge in California, that was demanding old age pensions and really put that issue on the table. You had people like Huey Long that were constantly pushing Roosevelt, dragging Roosevelt to the left, you know, and you had, above all, you had organized labor. And when we talk about the sort of golden age of this country, you know, the period from World War II up to the 1970s, where the country was prosperous, the economy was growing by leaps and bounds all the time, and wealth was shared. I mean, that's the world I grew up in, where Americans were, we were all middle class. That was the whole idea. You've seen my lecture before, but I always talk about J. Paul Getty, who was the richest man in the world when I was born in 1965, and his net worth when he died was $2 billion, richest man in the world.
Yeah.
And it's like these Wall Street guys, there's guys that make that much in a single year nowadays, you know? Mm-hmm. The world is coming apart. But what made that world that you and I grew up in, we don't think of it this way because maybe, you know, it's sort of been, there's not a lot of images of it and it's been canceled out of our national memory, but it was organized labor. That's what changed the world that we grew up in, you know, beginning in the 30s. Organized labor, Social Security, the regulation of banks. You know, these are the pillars of that America that is now has just been dissolved over the last 20 years. We have to get those things back. I don't know whether it'll come back in the same form. I mean, we don't really manufacture that much in this country anymore. So something like a sit-down strike at a GM plant is probably not going to change things. You know, and besides, those guys already have a union. But something has to happen, and it has to happen soon. So let's – I have high hopes, Peter B.
So you identify with that Target employee who didn't want to work all night after Thanksgiving on Black Friday? is that the seed of a new labor movement to take on Target?
I hope so. And you're forever reading about the efforts to, you know, the organized Walmart. You know, I would love to see something like that happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, it's always interesting to talk with you. You got a new book coming out in January?
So they say.
Yeah. Pity the Billionaire. Does it have a lengthy subtitle that goes on for a day and a half?
Oh, you know it. You know, one of these days I'm going to write a book with a one-word title and no subtitle. But yes, here's the subtitle. You're going to like this.
Yeah.
The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right.
Okay.
So it's about the period after the 2008 elections when everybody said the right is flat on its back. They're done for. You remember all those predictions?
I do.
And look what happened. Look what happened.
They give good smack, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you look at this payroll tax cut bill that Boehner has put through, it's got the poison of the Keystone XL. And it's like, you know, they're flipping the bird at Obama and the Democrats every chance they get.
They play the game so very well. And by the way, I have a really good 30s comparison for them. You'll see in the book.
All right.
One of the big actors of the 1930s was also really dedicated, really well organized, had this movement culture, never missed a trick. Who am I talking about, Peter B?
I don't know.
A Communist Party.
Oh, the commies. Wow.
There are a lot of really weird similarities. You'll see.
Okay, well, when this gets published,
they're cultural similarities. Of course, politically, they're on the opposite sides of the coin. But
have a bag packed and a lawyer on call, because you could be subject to indefinite detention without charge.
You think they're going to haul me off to Gitmo, are they?
I'm worried for you. If you bring in the commies, that could seal it for you. Thomas Frank, always a pleasure to talk with you. And can we make a commitment now to talk after I've read your book in January?
Of course. Absolutely.
All right. We'll
do it before then.
Okay.
Whenever you're good and ready.
All right. Thanks for joining me today here on the PBC show.
You got it, man.
Thanks for listening to our frank and rambling conversation with Thomas Frank. Send me an email, why don't you? Peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.